Well, there are some overlaps here, obvious ones, with Matthew 22, verses 34 to 40. Here's another instance of a text which, grammatically is pretty straightforward. The question then becomes how best to work with it in its context in Matthew. It comes as it does at the end of chapter 22 and the series of disputes. You remember, Jesus has laid things out in the open in 21 with the parable of the wicked tenant farmers. The kingdom of God will be taken from you, at verse 43, and then the wedding feast, where, which is the preeminent parable to show that parables are not just ordinary stories, you know. Because the guy sets a feast, and he invites the guests, and the guests say, well, I can't come. And he puts the food on the back burner, and he sends his army, and he kills all those suckers, you know? Well, this is not exactly what you normally do when you give a wedding feast. And he burned their city. It's like, I mean, Octavio would never do that. If he set food for the students and the students didn't come, you know. He might, especially for some students, right? The controversy is rising. You know, Jesus tells that parable, which ends at verse 14, and then the Pharisees in verse 15, we read that, take counsel against him to trap him, and then he defeats them. And then, for some reason, we've skipped the reading, the paragraph on the Sadducees, who take their turn at Jesus with this phony question. See, again, it's all these phony questions, right? There's a phony question about, should we pay taxes to Caesar? There's a phony question about, in the resurrection, whose wife will she be, you know? And Jesus says, you guys don't know the Bible or God's power, you know? So, again, this is thrust, parry, thrust. You know, that's what's going on. Well, verse 34 is the last in the sequence of three incidents, which is then followed by Jesus completely turning the tables, because, in a sense, then he takes the offensive and he asks them a question, right, in the last pericope. So this is the next to the last pericope. It's the last time they approach him in verse 34. And the Pharisees, hearing, accusantes, aorist participle active, referent, masculine plural nominative, the referent is the Pharisees. When they heard that, Hutti introducing the object of hearing, or maybe better, the indirect discourse, reporting now what they heard, that, ephimosen, we just worked this through with the beginning Greek students, they heard that he had silenced the Sadducees. They synekthesan, epita auta. They synagogued themselves. And this is, you may remember that Veltz in his grammar has this discussion of how a verb which is originally transitive and active in the passive form can come to have an intransitive active meaning. You're going, oh yeah, I was thinking about that the other day. Anyway, it's even though it's aorist indicative passive, it's not they were gathered, but it's just they gathered. It comes to have an intransitive active meaning. So the Pharisees gathered, epi ta auta. This probably, I looked this up in the lexicon, it probably means together or maybe in the same place. But I think there's something intentional going on here. That is where St. Matthew is letting us know that we're ratcheting up a notch here. Now they don't just take counsel together. Now they're gathering all in the same place. The scene is there's a bunch of Pharisees now, and they're all in the same spot. Okay, and then verse 35, kai ep erotizen heis ex auton, and one of them asked, he may or may not have been a lawyer, depending on the variant reading, this actually probably is, well, I didn't even check it out, to tell you the truth. It's not all that strongly attested, but anyway, it doesn't really matter whether you read it or not. One of them asked, peirazon auton, woodenly, or weasel translation, testing him. Now, I think it's a little obvious from the context that this is not a neutral test. This is a tempting, right, a hostile endeavor on their part. And because it's a present participle and because it follows the main verb, I think it expresses purpose. And that, in fact, is the way the RSV translates it. And I think they get it right. That is, they asked, one of them asked in order to test him. Okay. Again, the rule of thumb for when predicate position participles can express purpose, I think they pretty much have to follow the main verb. They won't precede it. And they'll be present tense in the New Testament. In classical Greek, they would be future tense. And there is one example later on in Matthew of a future tense perfect participle. It's the only one, apparently, according to Blasterbrunner. So backing up, and one of them asked him in order to test him. Teacher, didascale, vocative, right? Which commandment, great in the law? well, you supply is. And the grammars also indicate that the opinion that megale here is the use of the regular, the positive form of the adjective for the superlative. This is a Hebrew thing. You don't have a form in Hebrew to do greatest, do you? No, so you do it with context. And so the correct translation would be, teacher, which commandment in the law is greatest? Okay, now notice they ask about the law, because there's a contrast when we get to the end of the paragraph. Verse 37, but he, now again this ha, da, where the subject shifts, and now it's Jesus, but he, efe, this is from phemi, a verb that's pretty well dropped out of the New Testament except to introduce direct speech like this in most cases. It is actually an imperfect indicative, if I'm remembering right, but you just translate it like an aorist. It's like apen. But he said to him, auto, you will love, agapeses, future indicative active, you will love the Lord, the God of you. Now, end with the dative. Here, I think we're expressing the instrument. With the whole the heart of you, and with the whole the life of you, and with the whole the understanding of you. The sense here is probably, this is probably not an opportunity to preach a three-part sermon on how to love, you know, God. It's just a, you know, it's with your whole being, right? Any one of these three could have stood and communicated, but now we're just going to say it, Jesus is going to say it fully, quoting from the Shema, I'm guessing there, looking at the footnote in Deuteronomy 6. So he chooses this one. It's not one of the ten, but he quotes from the Shema, and then verse 38, he continues, he gives them well, first he says this, haute, as to this is the great and first commandment. And then he continues, and second, deutera, homoio aute, like to it. Now he cites from the verse that we had earlier from Leviticus 19. Agapeses, you will love, ton plesion sou. Plesion simply means near, but with the article it means the near guy or the neighbor. You will love your neighbor as seoton, as yourself. Now here comes the interesting feature. I actually had never really noticed this before looking at this morning. On these two commandments, en tautes tais duzin en tolais, halas hanamas, the whole law, krematai, this is from kremanumi. I mean, the verbs from Hades are the me verbs, you know. And this is the present indicative middle or passive. It has an intransitive sense. Not the law is hung, but simply the law hangs. Okay? And again, you just get that from the big lexicon. On these two commandments, the whole law hangs and the prophets. See, Jesus adds, and the prophets. I don't want to just get in some silly debate with you about which is the great commandment. See, I'm going to tell you what the whole revelation of God is in response to your question. Now, what are you going to do with this text? There's a number of things you could do. You could simply preach it straight as is, and that would probably be fine, you know, to this and take this, I suppose, you could take it as third use of the law in a valid sense. You know, I was thinking, as Dr. Roald was speaking, you know, we are holy because of our relationship with Yahweh, who is holy, and then he calls upon us to look like it, to act. Won't even come close to doing this perfectly, which is why there's this thing called sacrifice, and ultimately the once-for-all sacrifice. But you are holy, so now look like it. Act that way. Live in a manner worthy of the calling with which you've been called. Okay, so that you could go that way with this text. But in Matthew, and where it sits now in its context, I wonder if Jesus is using this for second use of the law. See? Just because the text before it, it's, once again, they thrust, he parries, and then thrust. See? So the real point of the text before it is not, let's have a discussion about church and state, but it's rather sort of an indirect attack, rhetorically indirect attack on Jesus, that the religious leaders are not giving to God the things that are God because they're opposing Jesus. See? And he does the same thing in the text that follows because he says, whose son is the Christ? And they say, David's. He said, well, then he poses them a conundrum. He says, well, how come David calls him Lord? See? What he wants them to say is that the Messiah is not only son of David, but that he's the son of God. But this they will not say. So I actually wonder if this is second use of the law here, and Jesus is trying to, again, because he ratchets it up. They ask about the law. He tells them this is the law and the prophets. See? They're all gathered together in opposition, testing him. And I wonder if his purpose is simply to crush them, you know, an attempt to say, you want to know about the will of God? You think you're doing the will of God? I'll tell you the will of God. Okay? So I think you could go either way. You know, you could make it Christian third use of the law in light of who Christ is and who we are in Christ. Or you could use it to attack some sort of carnal security, you know, any thought that, and I actually think, again, in context, because these are not, he's not talking to Christians here, you know. These are people who hate him, who are opposing him, who are trying to destroy him. Right? Now, once again, as I said before, you got to be real careful if you're going to preach that kind of a text to a Christian congregation, you know, on the assumption that they are baptized, that they came to church because they believe in Jesus. You know, you don't want to just go ripping into them as if they were, you know, exactly the same people as these Pharisees are. Nevertheless, we can artfully expose through the law that even in our lives as Christians, there are times and ways in which we get to feeling smug about our performance and how we think we're kind of doing just fine on the basis of what we have done, see. So if you're going to go that way, you got to be artful about it and careful that you don't simply say things that aren't true to the baptized Adah congregation, the Kahal of God. So, yeah, please.
It's just that, of course, this conversation or dialogue that happens is that I get the feeling that I look at these Pharisees as like a confirmands from hell.
The confirmands from hell. Let's see. Tell me more. What do you mean by that? Yeah, well, that's just it. I mean, even didaskala is ironic. By the way, I forgot to mention that. The disciples of Jesus in Matthew never call him didaskalos. Never. Only kurios. So in Matthew's literary context, the very fact that they call him teacher means that they don't understand who he is. That's it. I'm glad you mentioned. I forgot to say that. Yeah. Surely. Yeah. And they've called him that before, right? In verse 16 of chapter 22. Didaskala, teacher, we know that you are true. Play the violin music. And the way of God in truth you teach. And you don't care about what anybody thinks, right? See this. They're using it in a formally appropriate way. But they don't really think he's the teacher sent from God. Otherwise, they wouldn't be doing what they're doing. Exactly, exactly. So see, once again, you know, in context, this text takes on a particular cast, a particular hue. And then the challenge becomes how to preach this to a Christian congregation. Now, if you were talking to a high school baccalaureate or something and never wanted to be invited back, then it'd be real clear what to do, you know. Yeah, Mark?
What is the, what are they trying to catch you? When they ask what law is the greatest?
Yeah. I think that, you know, the common opinion is probably right. I certainly don't have any better idea that they're trying to draw them into their debates, you know, about which is the greatest commandment. You know, they're focused on the law and they have the list of 613, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And apparently there's some evidence that, you know, this was a thing to be discussed. Is there one commandment which is greater than the others? And if it is, which is it? So they're trying to draw him in so that he can become vulnerable to attack. In the same way that they tried to draw him in with, shall we pay taxes to Caesar? Because if he says yes, then the zealots hate him. If he says no, the authorities are suspicious. Right? So they're trying to draw him in, and you see he simply refuses to be drawn into their game. Right? He doesn't quote any of the ten. He quotes the Shema, right, which is the central confession of Israel's faith. And then he says, this isn't just the law, it's the whole revelation of God. Buddy. I mean, that's kind of what he's doing here. Yeah. Oh, time to stop. Class starts in 20 seconds or something. All right. Good. Thank you.